Mitch, is your camera up on your ceiling? It looks like it's coming down at you.
Well, I'm in a new office and I'm in a conference room, and yes, it's on top of my big screen.
It's the aerial view.
Yes.
There's two call-in users. Is one of them Tyler, maybe? Does anybody else call in by a phone?
Good morning. This is Robin, but I'm on my laptop.
Okay. Thanks, Robin. All right. I don't know. We have to do something new with this meeting with the public comment, so that might be part of that. All right, Bobby, I'm going to get started. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
All right. Good morning, everybody. I'd like to call the August 18th Pension Committee meeting to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the May 19th, 2022 minutes. Are there any questions or comments about those minutes? Okay, hearing none, they will stand approved. The next item is a new item on our agenda. Per Delaware state law, any public meetings must now have public comment. So at this time, I'm going to open up the floor for any public comment. Operator, is there anybody on the phone that would like to speak to the Pension Committee?
At this time, there is currently no one on the line.
Okay, thank you. All right, at this time, we will close the public comment period. All right, the next item is an update on the pension and OPEB performance, and we have Pat Wing here, and I'll turn it over to him.
All right, great. Thank you, Gina, and good morning, everyone, again. So, and before I bring up the materials here, just quickly, it seems like, every time we meet in the middle of the subsequent quarter, it's a wildly different market environment than what we just finished as far as quarter end. I'm sure all of you well know that markets have rebounded quite dramatically here in July and the first half of August. So, when this tends to happen, as it has over the past several quarters, I'll try to weave in some commentary when I start walking through the book as it relates to the economy and markets. We do have the July performance update, so it'll become apparent when we walk through that as well. But also weave in some commentary and things of the nature as some of the changes that we've been that we made in Q2 and more recently at the end of last week and why. And then really start to set the stage for our asset allocation discussion, which will occur in February subsequent to the next actuarial meeting. So I just wanted to provide that quick context. And if you'll bear with me quickly here, I will try and bring up the books. Here we go. Okay. Can everybody see my screen there? Yes. Okay, great. So before we dive into the numbers, as you know, we like to spend, 5, 6 minutes talking about the economy and capital markets in general, just to provide context for how and why the funds performed the way they did, how why some of the underlying investment managers performed the way they did. And again, I'm going to talk a lot about, not just what happened in Q2, but our view on sort of the economic outlook, the market outlook, and how that's feeding into some of the changes that we made and are thinking of making moving forward here. Now, with that said, we'll start with the U.S. economy as we always do. I'm sure you all well know the economy did enter into a quote-unquote technical recession in Q2, defined as two negative GDP prints in a row. Now, as I'm sure you all are well aware, there's some call it debate going on these days about whether or not we're actually in a recession or not. Now, that whole point is somewhat semantics to us because the economy is clearly slowed, right? There's no arguing that. And the slowing economy has had a big impact on markets, certainly in Q2. And some of the changes as it relates to the Fed outlook, we believe are driving the rebound here, at least in the early part of Q3. But before I get into that latter point, I think it's important to note, you know, what drove the economic weakness in Q2? Similar story as Q1, we had a slowdown in private inventory investment. We had a slowdown in consumer spending. Yeah. And then we also had a big contraction in residential property investment by about 14%, largely due to, we believe, you know, rising mortgage rates and somewhat of a slowdown, maybe at the early stages in the housing market. Now, it's certainly an open question whether or not the National Bureau of Economic Research ultimately says, you know, we are in recession. They do look at a broad range of indicators. And when you look at the economy these days, most sectors have either slowed or are pretty weak. You know, the one standout that everybody's been citing these days is certainly the labor market. We talk about that in the second bullet point. And during the first half of the year, the job market generated about an average of 375,000 jobs. We saw another very strong report in July to the tune of about 520,000 jobs. But it's important to recognize that that report, while everybody sort of hangs on it every month, is very much a lagging indicator. So if you take a step back and think about it, when a company decides to open a position, right, they define the scope, they post it, they use a headhunter, you know, they get resumes in, they interview candidates, they finally extend an offer, and then maybe it's a few weeks for somebody to accept that offer, right? So the job gains that we see each month, that has been put in motion 4 or 5 months earlier, right? Those decisions to add those jobs. So that's why it's somewhat of a lagging indicator. Now, if we look at the labor market at some more timelier indicators, we think those weekly jobless claims reports, where you see initial jobless claims and related to that continuing jobless claims, are more timelier, right? So continuing jobless claims, meaning that people that aren't filing for the first time but are continuing to file unemployment claims. And you know, Deutsche Bank put out some pretty interesting research that we cite here below and show a chart to the right. But what they found is over time, once the continuing claims level has increased by about 12% above its trough, then a recession typically follows in about 2 months. And you can see that in the chart here where the darker line is showing those continuing claims. The darker blue rows are showing the trough, and then the shaded blue are basically recession. So we ended the quarter about 5% above that trough. The report came out this morning. I haven't seen it yet. But as of last week, we're about 9% above that trough. So if we look at more real-time indicators in the labor market, it's sort of showing a different picture than those headline jobs numbers that we've been seeing more recently. Now, with that said, you know, two key themes that have really been the themes that everybody's hanging on and we believe will continue to be important, namely inflation and what the Fed is doing. So as it relates to the former inflation, we did see inflation come in through June at about 9.1% from the year earlier. It was the highest level since the early 80s. But as we know in the first bullet point here, looking ahead, we thought that may mark the peak of inflation. So in other words, the level of inflation was probably going to continue to remain high, but the rate of change was going to slow. And we did see that with the July report, showed inflation increasing at 8.5%. So again, a very high level, but a slowdown from what we saw in June. So what's driven that? You know, we've seen some alleviation in supply chain, which has been helpful for goods prices or the stuff that we buy that really drove a lot of the initial inflation out of the pandemic. We've seen commodity prices like oil prices, gas, food, lumber prices also come down about 25% to 35% off their highs, or even maybe a little bit more. And those drawdowns haven't really filtered into the data too much yet. The markets are also expecting a more benign inflationary environment. If you look at this top chart here, it's just what the fixed income markets are projecting for inflation over the next 10 years. And you can see we peaked at a pretty high level north of 3.1% in late April, but then saw a pretty dramatic decline through quarter end, ending at a little under 2.3%. So not only, again, is inflation likely to decelerate, but the market is projecting a more benign environment. Now, that said, despite these sort of early signs, as we talk about in this third bullet point, the Fed remains pretty adamant, at least at this point, that they are going to continue to raise rates and raise rates pretty rapidly, really at the fastest pace that we've seen since the early 80s. So through June, they raised short-term rates by about 1.5 percentage points. They did another 3/4 in July, and their next meeting is in September. And right now, the market's pricing in 100% probability of a 0.5 percentage point increase and about a 50-50 shot at another 75. And really why that's important and sort of that narrative drove, we believe, a lot of the market downturn in Q2 was that, again, as I mentioned, the economy's clearly slowing. And the Fed tightening policy is really continuing to pump on the brakes of the economy, but that policy impact, it happens with a lag, right? When they raise rates today, we don't feel it completely tomorrow. We feel it maybe 6-9 months ahead of time. So with these huge rate increases in June and July and maybe in September, we're really not going to feel the economic impact of that until maybe the end of this year, early part of next year. Now, interestingly, there's been a gulf that's developed here between what the market thinks the Fed's going to do versus what the Fed says they're going to do. And that's illustrated in the bottom chart here, where the darker line is showing historical short-term rates. The green line here extended off of that is what the market thinks the path of short-term rates is going to be. And then the blue line is what the Fed has signaled they're likely going to do. So you can see they overlap through the end of this year. So the two are in lockstep that rates are going to continue to rise. But you can see this green line has actually come down. In other words, the market is pricing in the likelihood that the Fed is going to reverse course next year around Q1 or Q2 and begin cutting rates because they're moving too far, too fast. And we think that's the narrative that the market has really jumped on here in Q3. In other words, we've seen a lot of tightening. We're going to continue to see a little bit more, but the Fed's going to reverse course, and that should lead to a more benign economic environment in the back half of 2023. So the market obviously anticipates or attempts to anticipate changes in policy, changes in the economy, changes in corporate fundamentals. And as the market has started to price in Fed rate cuts, in theory, that should lead to more benign conditions across those various areas that I just mentioned. So that's driven a lot of the rebound that we've seen in markets in Q3, in our opinion. Now, as far as markets in Q2, based on the economic overview I just ran through, and I'm sure you all well know, it was a tough market, to say the least, across all asset classes. Whether it be equities up here, you can see U.S. equities in the green bar, where all green bars are the Q2 numbers, down almost 17%, international down a little less than 15%, emerging down a little bit more than 11%. Really right across the board because of that, you know, poor economic outlook and the Fed tightening policy continuing in the middle of the year. And similar to Q1, what we saw was fixed income also posting a negative return here. You can see down almost 5% after Q1, that it was down about 6%. So again, sort of this continuation of an historical anomaly where bonds were usually the ballast of the portfolio when equities are taking it on the chin. But given the Fed has been raising rates pretty dramatically, that's put upward pressure on other rates, intermediate and longer term, which puts downward pressure on bond prices. Now, importantly for the funds, this return is representative of the broad investment grade bond market, whereas the benchmark we use for the pension and the OPEB is the Intermediate Government Credit Index. And I mention that because it has a shorter or lower duration or less interest rate risk. So when rates move, it doesn't impact the bond prices of that benchmark nearly as much as the broad benchmark. So the benchmark for the two funds was only down about 2.4% for the quarter, just about half of that broader bond benchmark, again, given the latter has much more exposure to what rates are going to do. Now, sticking within fixed income here for just a minute, because this will lead into some comments on some changes we've made, you can see high yield bonds here down about 10%. In Q2, that's what you would expect, right? Sub-investment grade debt issued by, you know, more cyclical, more leveraged, more volatile type of bonds, really falling hard in sympathy with the downturn in equity markets. But with that downturn, what happened was the spread or the additional yield that those bonds were providing investors rose above their historical averages relative to treasury bonds. So in other words, their valuations became much more attractive. So when we think about, you know, where are we getting paid to take risk when things are declining, the high yield market was one of them, because those valuations, again, became much cheaper than they were at the beginning of the year and cheaper than their historical averages. So we added some funds to high yield bonds towards the end of the quarter, which wasn't very helpful as the markets continued to sell off, but was very helpful in July and in the first half of August. The last thing I'll mention on the market environment here on this page, the data isn't on here because it isn't ready, but as we'll see here shortly, private real estate was up about 7%, private infrastructure up about 1.6%. So those additional asset classes for diversification, downside protection, really in this sort of environment that the committee has approved over the past few years, proving very helpful, at least on the total fund level, having, you know, 10% allocated to those areas at a time where, again, traditional markets like equities and fixed income have been under a lot of pressure. A couple other quick comments here before moving on into the funds themselves. Within the U.S. equity market, it was red across the board from a sector perspective. You can see all the returns here on the top right where the lighter bars are Q2. But there was a massive range or a very wide dispersion across the returns. So you can see the best performing sector, consumer staples, down a little less than 5%. Where the worst performer, consumer discretionary, down around 26%. So almost a 21.5 percentage point range. And the sectors that did the best were really those defensive ones, like staples, like healthcare, like utilities. So that was helpful on a relative basis for some of the more defensive managers within the funds that we'll see here shortly. The other thing that was helpful was the fact that value stocks topped growth stocks once again during the quarter. So over the past, say, 5, 7, 10 years, the past 6 months notwithstanding, growth stocks have really run very far ahead of value stocks because rates have remained low and had declined. But once rates reversed course as well, value stocks took the baton and really led their growth stock and broad market counterparts. And that was helpful on a relative basis for the funds. We have a value tilt within the U.S., within international equities, in anticipation of those rising rates, which would, we thought, lead to value outperformance. Plus, coupled with the fact that given value has underperformed for so long, now we argue that it's cheap relative to the broad market and relative to its growth counterparts. Two other quick things I want to note, and then I'll pause here before we jump into the funds, is one chart for historical context and then another one for an illustration of why we made the change around high yield. So some pretty interesting analysis up here on the chart or the table to the right, where Bank of America measured the post-World War II S&P 500 bear market. So in other words, peak to trough decline of at least 20%. And the drawdowns in all those respective bear markets, and also whether or not they occurred amid a recession. So it's a pretty interesting takeaway here. So the average of them all is about 32%. But as we note here in the bullet, there's a big divergence about the average, whether or not it occurred amid a recession or whether it did not. So if it's amid a recession, it's about 36%. And if it's not, it's about 25%. And we hit that 25% in mid-June for the S&P. So again, the key question going forward, at least from a market perspective, Fed tightening, how does that impact in the economy? And how is that going to impact corporate fundamentals or corporate earnings? Because if we do see another, you know, decent leg down in the market, we think now it's really going to be driven by the fact that these higher input costs for companies aren't being completely passed along to consumers. So in other words, their margins are going to come under pressure and probably lead to earnings a little bit worse than the market is currently predicting. So at this point, we've seen, you know, a 25% drawdown. And the current quarter, I think the markets are up somewhere around 14% or so. So we've recouped, about half that. But moving forward in the back half of the year, we think things are going to continue to be a little bit more volatile. Not necessarily see another 25% drawdown, but given the Fed continuing to tighten and given the fact that, again, we think earnings might come in a little bit below expectations, we continue to maintain a more defensive posture within the funds. And then lastly, just quickly down here below, some pretty interesting analysis, and I think it's really another driving factor, not just valuations, but taking into account, again, where we may be in the economic cycle and what that means for, say, equity returns versus high yield bonds. And you can see what this measures is basically the four parts of the economic cycle, whether we're early, mid, late, or in a contraction, and then the average next 12-month returns for U.S. equities here in the darker bars, high yield bonds in the lighter blue bars, and then the difference between the two in the gray bars. So when the economy is really ramping up in the early mid cycle, equities tend to do better, right? Not surprising, corporate earnings are rising at a pretty fast clip. So equities are outperforming. Now, when the economic cycle gets in the latter stages before recession, you can see the performance gap tends to narrow. And then when we're in a contraction, high yield bonds actually outperform equities to a pretty dramatic margin. So again, when we take a step back and we're thinking, where are we going to be compensated for taking additional risk given the uncertain outlook, not just on the valuations, but the fact that if we are late cycle or in a contraction over the next 12 months, it tends to be a more favorable environment for high yield bonds than for equities. So that's why, again, we added some funds to high yield bonds towards the end of the quarter. So with that said, let me pause there to see if there are any comments or questions and before we jump into the fund results themselves. Okay. So we'll start with the pension and we'll do a pretty detailed overview here and then more quickly on the OPEB since the investment lineup mimics the pension. But at a high level, you can see up top here for observations. The market value of the fund at the end of June was $136.4 million. Now it's much higher as we sit here today, given the rebound in markets, and we'll show you that with the update here in just a minute. But as far as what drove the market value decline in Q2, it was mainly the net investment change, which was down about $14.4 million. The fund did return negative 9.4%. which was ahead of that policy index benchmark per the investment policy statement that was down 10.5%. And given the poor returns in Q2 for fiscal year, it's a similar story, you know, a little bit smaller net investment loss, a little bit better of a return, about 1.5 percentage points ahead of that policy index benchmark. Now for the quarter itself, when we think about, you know, what explains how the fund did versus that benchmark, there were a few things that were very helpful. Number one, asset allocation. So having more money relative to the target in areas that did well, like real estate, like infrastructure, less money in areas that did poorly, like equities. Most of the active equity managers outperformed their respective benchmarks. You see here, shortly, Clarion was up around 7% versus its peer group that was only up about 4.5%. So that was also helpful on a relative basis. Now, what was a little bit of a detractor was private infrastructure, even though it was up about 1.6%. The benchmark that we use for that is consumer price inflation plus 4%. So that inflation plus premium. And since inflation has just been running at historically high levels, that CPI plus 4 came in at around 4% during the quarter. So again, even though JP Morgan was positive, it was about 2.5 percentage points behind that benchmark. And then one of the short-term active fixed income managers also underperformed slightly. So as we look ahead here, again, as I mentioned a second ago, we'll do that asset allocation review after the next actuary presentation. But right when we wrap up, I just want to make a couple additional comments, again, try to set the stage for those discussions that will occur in the first half of next year. So with that said, just at a high level, before we get more granular into some of these data, you can see up top the summary of cash flows for the pension. So we began the quarter about $152.7 million. There was a net cash outflow of about $1.95 million. So all told, the fund decreased by about $16.3 million during the quarter. You can see the Q2 returns here that I mentioned a second ago and some more short, intermediate, and long-term returns. We'll hit those in just a second when we look at them from a peer perspective. But I wanted to note, just to illustrate my comments earlier, when you look at the equity asset classes, whether it be U.S., global, or non-U.S., in aggregate, we ended the quarter about 2 percentage points underweight equities, again, still being a little bit more defensive. And obviously, if you're underweight something, you have to be overweight somewhere else. And that was really in real estate and infrastructure, again, the asset classes that have been doing pretty well in this inflationary environment. Now, one of the other changes that are sort of in the works, as you can see here, real estate is about 7.5% versus that policy target about 5%. So we put in partial redemptions for the real estate allocation for both funds, taking it back, not quite to target, but closer to target, really for two reasons. Number one, the commercial property market tends to respond with a lag to what the public markets do. So when we think about the performance in the first half of the year, in other words, the stocks of companies that own and operate commercial real estate, they were down around 15 to 20%. And when you have that weakness in the public markets, it tends to flow through to the private markets with about a 9 to 12 month lag. So we put in those redemptions in the middle part of the year with the expectation that hopefully we'll get most of that back before we see any weakness in the commercial property market. And secondly to that, if we do see this volatile environment that we expect in maybe the back half of Q3 and the early part of Q4, then as we get that money back, then that'll give us a more opportune or more attractive opportunity to rebalance back into other areas after they decline, or in other words, you know, a cheaper entry point. So with that said, let's look at some of the returns here. We'll start at a high level and talk about some of the managers. So on this page, this is the peer rankings page that we've talked about many times before. Again, just giving us the opportunity to compare how the fund is doing to many other public defined benefit funds across the US here on an anonymized basis. So a lot going on in this page. The real takeaways here are down below where you see the circle and the X. So as we work our way from left to right here, for the quarter, again, you see the returns I cited a few seconds ago, and then in parentheses are the ranks. So the negative 9.4% was good for top 23% in this universe. Again, lower numbers here in parentheses are better. You know, really driving that outperformance relative to the peer group is pretty much what drove the outperformance relative to that policy, right? Asset allocation, having more funds in those asset classes like real estate and infrastructure that did well, active equity manager outperformance, and things like that. And if you look at the year-to-date and 1 year now, it's a pretty similar story, sort of top quintile type ranks in a very poor market environment. And now those intermediate and longer term numbers are pretty much, you know, comfortably ahead of the median, whether it be the 3, 5, or 10 year periods. So as far as some of the manager returns themselves, again, we'll look at these and then we'll round out with the OPEB here quickly before looking at the July update. If you look up top and see this darker brown row, those are the total fund returns that were on the previous page on the peer rankings. And anytime you see another darker row, you see the word composite. It's just another word for asset class. So the total equity asset class or composite, a weighted average of US, non-US, and global equity managers, you can see it was about 1.5 percentage points ahead of the benchmark, really owed to outperformance across those three regions, starting with the US about 1 percentage point ahead, really due to a couple things. Number one, the active manager in the mid-cap space that I talked about in the market environment outperformed. Their more defensive type manager and more defensive areas did well. So we would expect them to do well in this environment on a relative basis, which they did. And then again, a tilt towards value stocks here in this small cap value space, which were down about 14.4%. But that was well ahead of the broad market that was down 16.7%. So again, having a tilt towards value when value outperformed was helpful when you put the pieces together relative to the benchmark. For global equities, a similar story, about a 2.5 percentage point outperformance. About three of the four managers outperformed their respective benchmarks during the quarter. So the outperformance of those managers relative to their benchmarks drove the relative gains there. Within non-US, it's a similar story to the US, and you know, we have that value tilt. So you can see we're expressing that here through this Schroders fund. You can see the benchmark, their value benchmark was outperforming the broader non-US benchmark by about 2 percentage points. So again, having more money in an area that did better was helpful. But the other key thing that drove the outperformance was down here below where you see Wellington Emerging Markets Opportunities. Not only did they outperform their respective benchmark, but again, emerging market stocks did much better than the broad non-US market. So that was also helpful from a relative basis. Real estate, like I mentioned earlier, see Clarion here up a little north of 7%, well ahead of their benchmark, so that was helpful. But then infrastructure here below, up about 1%. So even though JP Morgan was up 1.6, we do complement them with a small allocation here to listed infrastructure. So Cohen & Steers that's buying and selling the stocks of companies that own and operate infrastructure assets, just to help us with rebalancing across the fund. So again, even though it was up 1.6, the fact that this component of the asset class was down a little bit dragged that down to a little bit less than 1%, which again was well below the CPI plus 4 that was up north of 4%. But in this current quarter, we would expect this benchmark to be much lower. Everybody, I'm sure, saw that the July print for inflation was essentially zero. So as we look ahead, again, we're unlikely to see the benchmark up, hopefully 4.1% in any given quarter. And then finally, as it relates to fixed income, a little bit behind the benchmark during the quarter, Wilmington Trust actually ahead. And, you know, since we've got them to lower their fees, they've actually posted some fairly favorable returns relative to the benchmark and relative to the peer group. I think really owed to the fact that they are more defensive, you know, compared to the peer group, obviously a little bit compared to the benchmark showed here. So this environment, we would have expected them to perform well, and they did just that. But what drove the underperformance, or the slight underperformance, was again, the active fixed income short-term manager was slightly behind the benchmark. And then the high yield manager, even though we implemented it towards the back half of the quarter, really the back half of June, high yield bonds continued to sell off through the end of the quarter. So that detracted a little bit in Q2. So with that said, again, let me pause here. Any questions or comments before we jump into the OPEB quickly? Okay, let's see here. So as far as the OPEB is concerned, it's a similar story. Again, we'll get into the July update here in just a second. But the market value of the fund was about $55.5 million. You can see the net investment changes for the Q2 and fiscal year respectively. But obviously, it's going to be similar returns to the pension fund, given the investment lineup mimics it to a T. So any differences from the pension to the OPEB will really be due to really rebalancing cash needs, things of that nature. But more or less, they should be spot on over time. As far as attribution, it's the same story that I walked through with the pension itself. So I just want to show you the high level information and then the ranks, and then we'll shift gears into the July updates here. So for the OPEB, we began the quarter about $61.1 million. You can see the net cash flow slightly positive. The net investment change here down around $5.75 million. So all told, the fund decreased by about $5.6 million in Q2. Again, we'll look at the returns here shortly in just a second. But from an asset allocation perspective, it's the same story as the pension, right? We ended the quarter about 2 percentage points underweight equities, expressing that underweight through an overweight to real estate and infrastructure. And we did put in the partial redemption for real estate on the OPEB, just like the pension, for those reasons I outlined a few minutes ago. So with that said, let's look at the ranks here. If I get the right page, no, there we go. And then we'll shift gears into the July numbers. So as far as the OPEB, again, it's going to be a similar story, at least more recently when we began, you know, providing the new service that we did almost 3 years ago, I think about 2.5 years ago now as of these numbers. But as far as the ranks and the returns, similar story for quarter, year to date, 1 year, top quartile, top quintile. And then on the intermediate term basis, again, we've seen some improvement relative to that median. But then the 10-year more or less in line with it, slightly behind it on a 10-year basis. So we have seen, obviously, in a down market, really the absolute numbers are obviously, you know, tough to swallow, but on a relative basis to the benchmark and to the peer group, the fund is performing reasonably well, we'd argue. So with that said, that's all I wanted to hit on the OPEB, since all the managers are pretty much the same. Are there any questions or comments before I bring up the July update and then wrap up with some other comments as it relates to markets and looking ahead? Okay. So let me share the July update here. Okay. So assuming that you can see my screen still, we have the July update here. So again, it's a wildly different market environment. You can see QTD quarter to date. It's just July for the pension. was up a little north of 5%, about 0.4 percentage points behind that benchmark. So two things really drove the underperformance. Number one, as I mentioned, we ended the quarter about 2 percentage points underweight equities. And equities, you can see here in the U.S., were up around 9%, not as much in international, but being underweight in asset class that does very well is, you know, a little bit of a detractor on a relative basis. And then the other key thing was that, unlike the first half of the year, we saw rates stabilize and decline a little bit. So that caused a huge shift in the relative performance between value and growth stocks. So again, value had been well ahead of the game in the first half of this year. But once we saw rates stabilize a little bit, that shifted course, and growth stocks have ramped higher here in the first 6 weeks of the quarter. So again, that number is up here for July year to date now, down around 8.5%, a little bit ahead of that benchmark by about 0.8 percentage points. Again, within equities drove some of the underperformance here for a quarter to date, or really all of it, mainly owed to the global equity space and the non-US space. Unlike the first half of the year, only half of the managers outperformed in July, and they tend to be underweight sort of those smaller profitless tech stocks that have ramped higher so far here in July and August, right? The Zooms, the Pelotons, the DocuSigns, sort of those pandemic new age stocks that took it on the chin so hard in the first half of the year, they rebounded quite dramatically. And since we think they're lower quality type stocks, right, more volatile type areas, we usually use managers that tend to avoid them. So avoiding those stocks that did the best in July was a detractor. So the managers made money but didn't keep pace with the benchmarks due to an underweight to that area. In non-US, again, it was kind of the mirror image of the first half, or Q2 at least, where value stocks, again here, where we're expressing that overweight via Schroders, was about 2 percentage points behind the broad market. So again, having more money in an area that did a little bit worse was a detractor. And then we saw emerging market equities also pretty much get back the outperformance that they saw in Q2. So having a little bit more money there was also a detractor in July. So we don't have the real estate numbers yet. They're reported on a quarterly basis. Similar story for the private infrastructure. Global listed infrastructure did rebound like broader global equity markets. So the small allocation to the manager there was helpful during the quarter given its outperformance. But the key change that we talked about earlier, as far as the high yield bonds, we saw that payoff in July. So you can see the fixed income itself about 0.3 percentage points ahead. Wilmington Trust was slightly ahead, so was the active short-term manager, but even though the high-yield bond manager that we added funds to was behind the benchmark, you could see high-yield bonds were up around 5.5% to 6% compared to the broad benchmark that was only up 1.6%. So the flip side to the value comments I made earlier, having more funds in an area relative to the benchmark that did well was helpful from fixed income. Now, moving forward, I'd like to mention that at the end of last week, we pretty much liquidated all of this position. So at the end of Q2, those spreads that I talked about that had widened, in other words, sort of paying investors more for tolerating that risk, were attractive. But given this strong outperformance here in July, and given more outperformance in the first couple weeks of August, we essentially, you know, sort of took the win, if you will. Right, we initiated the position sort of 8 weeks ago. High yield bonds, again, were out ahead of July, ahead in August. They ramped up higher pretty quickly, so we took it off the table. The other thing that we did was, again, in anticipation of probably a more volatile environment ahead here in the back half of Q3 and maybe heading into Q4, is we did rebalance somewhat out of equities as well. So taking some risk off the table post this huge ramp higher that we've seen in the first 6-7 weeks of the quarter. Now for the OPEB, a similar story. I won't run through those dynamics because the conclusions are the same as the pension, but you can see here up 5% versus 5.5% for the benchmark. Again, any changes will really just be due to rounding, cash flows, things of that nature. So as we pause here and again think about things moving forward, I talked a little bit about the changes that we've made more recently, sort of our short-term outlook, but want to talk quickly here about, or set the stage for our discussions in February, is the actuary to present in November. On a longer term basis, you know, we think the inflationary sort of environment or dynamics are going to be materially, or let's say materially enough different than what we've seen over the past couple of decades. So in other words, over the past 20 years, notwithstanding the past 18 months, inflation has kind of run in this 1.5 to 2% range. And a lot of people owe it to really four factors, demographics, debt, technology, disruption, and globalization. Now, those first three pretty much remain, in with their previous trend, if you will. But the latter, globalization, and between supply chains, between sort of the divergence between the West and the East, the new CHIPS Act that was passed, maybe it was a month or so ago or 6 weeks ago, that's trying to onshore semiconductor production within the U.S., there's a cost to that, right? The reason globalization was, sort of done with through the, WTO, so the West benefited from cheaper input costs, cheaper goods and services that the East produced. But now that that's reversing, if we onshore chip production, then it's better from, say, a national security perspective, but it costs more to produce in the U.S. than it does elsewhere. So this deglobalization is going to reverse a lot of the sort of disinflationary impact that we've seen over the past 20 years. So when we think about it more broadly from an inflation perspective, again, the past 20 years, we've seen sort of 1.5-2%. We're thinking we're probably going to settle down in more, say, a 2.5-3.5% range, which, at first glance, you say, well, that's not that much more. But over a 10 to 12 year period, that's a lot more inflation when you compound that over time. So what does that mean for markets? Well, in the U.S., like we've seen the first half of this year, higher than anticipated or expected inflation is usually a headwind. On a relative basis, non-U.S. equities tend to outperform in that sort of environment. And right, if we look back to the 70s, non-U.S. stocks did better than U.S. equities because the dollar depreciated in that long-term inflationary environment, which was a tailwind for non-U.S. stocks. Things like real estate, things like infrastructure, again, we think are going to play a very important role given their inflation-sensitive characteristics. So if we do settle into that range, I think it's going to be important that given that change in sort of the structural outlook, it may not just be one discussion in February. It might be multiple discussions where we come in February and say, this is the current outlook for the asset allocation as we see it. Here are the risks as we see them. Here's maybe another asset class to consider, or maybe just changes within the current asset classes. And then subsequent to that, after some discussion, we can have a more detailed conversation and analysis about the outlook for, again, the current and any proposed changes. So with all that said, let me pause there. That wraps up all the comments I wanted to make today. But again, happy to answer any questions or comments from the committee.
Hey, Pat. So we recently lowered our assumed rate of return. Prior to all this coming out. Now, if the inspected inflation is going to be higher than what we normally, did we lower the assumed rate of return too low? Should we have not lowered it? And I guess I'm a little nervous because we've had all these losses. I mean, I'm going to report from $150 million last year to $136 million this year. What is going to impact my budget? And it was in the same year we lowered the assumed rate of return on top of all that.
Well, I think that will have an impact. So a couple of things, and I wish I had the previous report still up here, Gina, but the actuary, obviously, they do a five-year smoothing, right? So it's not just what happened in this previous year. I'm going to try and bring this up here quickly if I have a five-year number. It's not just what happened in this previous year, but they don't recognize the gains and losses. They don't recognize all the gains and losses relative to that assumed rate of return in 1 year, right? They smooth it out over time. So the fact that the return came in quite a bit below the assumed rate of return isn't going to have as big of an impact because in the previous four fiscal years, in aggregate, we were ahead of the game. Okay, so obviously there is going to be an impact to the budget, but when you look at the fiscal year return at first glance, I think it might be less than maybe you think just looking at those numbers. Now, related to your other comment around inflation, so when you think about that assumed rate of return, somewhere built into that is the inflation expectation. But what really where that comes into play is, you know, your salary increase assumption, right, for the active employees. So I think that's where you should think about, is that number right? Not necessarily the assumed rate of return, because if we do have this higher structural inflation, then capital markets outlook is probably a little bit more subdued. But where you could see a big impact is, say, your salary increase assumption is only, and I don't know what it is off the top of my head, only 2.5%. But because of what's happening with inflation, raises are coming in at 3.5%. You know, again, I don't know the number. That could have a bigger impact to the actuarial valuation, the funded ratio of the fund. So I would think about it from that perspective, not necessarily, you know, does higher inflation mean, you know, we should push that assumed rate of return back up? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. It's not the way I wanted to look at it, because that just makes it worse.
Well, I think, you know, when Chiron comes in, and maybe, Gina, it's something that you can ask them to speak to, is number one, how is the payroll changing relative to their assumption, and does anything need to be tweaked there? And number two, have other jurisdictions that they work with made any tweaks to that assumption, just given the inflation that we've seen? Because at the end of the day, you know, the costs of the plans are what they are, right? But those assumptions try to help the county properly fund for those coming costs over many decades over time. So to the extent that we can align the assumptions with what is actually happening, then that will ensure, obviously, you know, a more proper funding of the pension and of the OPEB over time.
Right.
Yeah, so that might be something for them to take a look at, or at least comment on when they come in here in November.
Yeah, we are definitely below what we expected. Our employees' increases in salaries are way higher than the assumption. So I know that is one of the parts we are going to have to talk about. And what that looks like going forward.
Right, so that would be an actuarial loss, yeah. Right? You know, so if those, not just the returns coming in below expectations, but the increases coming above expectation, is gonna essentially result in a higher liability than you were previously assuming,
yep.
Right? So I think that a lot of what people are looking at these days, that salary increase assumption, and the return expectation too. You know, prior to this year, returns have been so good that now is really the time to lower the assumed rate of return, because, you know, prior to the markets that we saw the first half of this year, you know, contributions were kind of lower than what many were anticipating. So I think you guys lowering the assumed rate of return is in lockstep with what many others are doing. You guys are even more conservative, which is great, because you're in a position you know, to meet those liabilities at that lower rate of return. But obviously moving forward here, we are hopeful that the current fiscal year is going to look a lot better than the one we just saw. So you always have to remember these things move in cycles. It was a tough last 6 months. The next few months are probably going to be a little bit more challenging, but when hopefully we get some clarity around the economic environment, around what the Fed's going to do, I think a more benign environment, at least in the short term, for next year is going to unfold. So hopefully fiscal year 23 is going to be much better.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Does anybody else have any questions for Pat?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Pat.
All right, thank you all.
Okay, and just a reminder, our meeting on November 17th will be in person. It is our large meeting with the actuary. Pat will be here as well. It should be an interesting meeting, because as I said, the numbers don't look good that they're gonna see. And I know that they smooth them over multiple years, but this is the first time it'll, with us lowering the assumed rate of return, that's gonna affect the numbers too. So it definitely will be an interesting meeting. All right. Anybody else have any other comments? Okay. It's time to adjourn. Can I have a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
I have a motion and a second?
I'll second.
Okay. I have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
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 All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Take care.